Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of December. Pigment Prejudice, an article in the University of Wisconsin Alumni Magazine, caught our attention. It's just a profound story on so many levels. Albino children are sometimes hunted in Tanzania and other countries because of superstition that their body parts bring good luck. And two UW alumni are helping children with albinism in Tanzania, where superstition threatens their lives at every turn. Our guests this hour are remarkable people, and they have been working in Tanzania for a number of years. They are now working on this specific project to provide a refuge for young children who are victims of incredible prejudice, pigment prejudice. And their lives really are threatened when they walk out the house each day. So they don't go outside, and their parents are threatened as well. So it's really disruptive. And actually, Eric and Karine spent some years in Tanzania before they realized the extent of this problem. For whatever reason, East Africa has a number of people who are albinos. And so we will talk about how they are labeled, how they are threatened, and the work that this couple has been doing with their family in Tanzania. Professor Eric Booz is a professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin Fond du Lac. He has extensive teaching at all kinds of colleges and universities. He is an attorney. He and his wife went to law school so they could help start a law school in Tanzania. They also run an organic farm outside of Elkhart Lake. Karine Booz is a physical therapist, and she's with us as well. And together, they are 20-year volunteers for the American Red Cross. They've served in Haiti and Tanzania. They have been in inner-city hospitals, AIDS clinics, leprosy clinics, school shelters, and halfway houses. And they are working now to turn a 10-acre site on the edge of the Serengeti into a refuge for up to 200 albino children. Eric, thank you so much for being with us. Karine, thank you so much for being with us. Hello to both of you.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Yeah, thank you. This is just a really incredibly remarkable story on so many levels. To begin with, the fact that you are human beings who have done more than most of us can do in probably five lifetimes. Can you tell me how you first went to Tanzania, and then when you realized that there was this enormous problem in Tanzania? You were there for some time before you realized the extent of discrimination, weren't you?
Yeah, that's correct. We actually had been serving in Tanzania, flying back and forth for more than 15 years when we first came onto the problem. And we had seen albino children, you know, every time we were there. We'd see them on the roadside, or we'd see them in the small villages. And we knew a little bit about the condition, and we knew that it was very difficult for them to be in the hot African sun and not to have skin pigment. But we didn't know how deep the problem actually ran. We thought, you know, that was kind of the extent of it was. Gee, they are subject to skin cancer and all kinds of problems. And so when we were confronted with the issue in its full-blown proportions, we were actually just blown away and quite embarrassed. I mean, we had been there so many years and just didn't know. And what we came to learn was that this is one of Tanzania's best-kept secrets, and we're finding that even as we're trying to do something about it, there are some obstacles. People don't want to let go of some of these cultural myths. Want to hang on to it, and that includes people even higher up in the government. So it is quite a problem, and it has been really suppressed for a number of years. And so kind of our main focus at this point is we just want to get the word out there and let people know that this is actually going on. And that's the first step, is just raising awareness and letting people know.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any idea, Karine, why it is that there are many people with albinism in East Africa?
We have found that for some reason there is a higher prevalence of albinism in Tanzania and Eastern Africa. We actually recently had some communication with a man who is studying the problem in Tanzania. Murray Brilliant is his name. Mm-hmm. And I believe the numbers are that 1 in 2,000 have albinism. Mm.
So that must be quite a bit higher than it is in other parts of the world.
Yes.
And from my understanding, just from the article, these people are, for the most part, kept inside, and their families are at some risk as well. So, you don't want to go out and work if your child's going to be abducted from your house. So everybody's staying home. And how would you even know about the existence of some of these families?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The numbers that anybody has on this issue are you know, best guesses. The BBC did a report some years ago that kind of put the total number of albinos in Tanzania around 180,000. Nobody can be entirely sure because, as you said, the families keep them secret because they don't want them to get abducted and murdered. So they live indoors. They live behind closed doors. Their lives are secretive. The albino children that live in the remote villages, even when they are abducted and killed, many times that will just go unreported, at least for years.
Oh. And do you understand where all of this came from? You hear this and you think, how in the world could people sell body parts from albinos? What in the world could take over somebody's mind that it would allow them to think that this would be okay?
Yeah, that is something that just floored Corrine and I. And I remember I was actually in a law school classroom teaching a class on human rights, and I brought up the issue, and there was just drop-dead silence, and nobody in the room wanted to talk about it. Eventually, when one student did kind of offer some information and shared a story of an abduction they knew about in their village, then that kind of opened the floodgate, and then everybody had a story about it. But my reaction personally, and Corrine's was as well, was how can there possibly be anybody in 2012 that
right.
still believes in this kind of magic?
Right.
How can you really believe that, you know, a talisman made of the skin of an albino is going to bring you luck in your fishing industry or luck in the mining industry? And then the other part that really hit us was the amount of money involved, because Tanzanians generally live on less than a dollar a day. And when we saw the numbers that were associated with the body parts, and we've even seen vials of the body parts and the potions in markets.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and the value of it is, the street value is astronomical. And we're just stuck wondering who even has this kind of money to buy this. And so we're floored. And we met one albino in particular at St. Augustine University in Mwanza. And he's mentioned in the article and on Wisconsin. His name is Boniface. He's fortunate because his father was a psychiatrist with a PhD, and so he had a little better than average education, and he was very articulate, and he could speak seven languages. But we sat down with him for a day, and we spent 4 or 5 hours, and he told us about what his life was like, how he lived in fear, how he was afraid to go for a walk, how he couldn't go to the store alone, how he couldn't even go out in the sun without his mother slathering him up in copious amounts of sunscreen. Mm. And then he went on to tell me about how many of his friends were missing body parts, how many of his friends had been abducted and had their hands cut off, their fingers cut off. Sometimes the abductors don't want to commit the full murder because they think if they get caught and they only just took some body parts, they'll get less of a sentence. But the one thing Boniface came back to was the reason that this is not changing faster is because there are people higher up that probably have something to do with this. And so we were just floored by it. It was really something.
Corrine, you must have been horrified by this.
Yes, I really was. When we first heard about it, again, as Eric said, we couldn't believe that this was still going on in this time and age. It, you know, brought tears to my eyes. I was quite upset about it. And for me, it just goes down to issues of justice. And anytime I see situations where people are suffering for reasons over which they have no control, that just really affects my sense of justice. And
yeah.
We knew that we had to get out there and help.
I know that you have set up a 501c organization. Can you talk about that?
I'm going to give that one to Corrine because the truth of the matter is, and everybody should know this, she by far and away outscored me in law school. She's the better attorney in the family. And so she did all the paperwork, and she has an attention for detail. So I'll let her talk to that one.
Corrine.
Thanks. Yeah, we went ahead, and this time in setting all of this up, we decided to do the paperwork for the 501c3 nonprofit organization. We're in the process of getting our tax-exempt status, and in prior years of doing some of the different projects that we have done in Tanzania, we've always just raised our own money, had generous donations from people, some grants, and we would take that money over, and 100% of what we got, we would apply to those projects. And now with our Zeru Zeru organization, again, we would like to be able to take as much of the grant money that we have. We want to have very low administrative costs and really work toward this project. However, this is different than the other projects that we've had in that we're going for a start of $450,000 just to get the campus built.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we want to work on the sustainability at the compound and work toward getting the kids integrated.
Mm-hmm. And you, Eric, are working with the United Nations, aren't you, and with the Tanzanian government, certainly, to address the human rights, and they are substantial concerns here.
Yeah, not the United Nations, but the African Union.
Mm.
And I was very fortunate. I just had a personal connection because the dean of the law school at St. Augustine's University in Mwanza is a personal friend of mine, and he had actually handpicked me to teach at St. Augustine's based on a book I wrote when I was a Fulbright scholar in Tanzania on the rights of pastoralists and the rights of women to property. And he had read that book, and then he kind of stalked me, I guess, for 5 years till he could get a hold of me and then invited me to come teach there. And then after I taught there a couple of times, he liked my scholarship, and he said, you know, can you bring some of this, you know, and write me some papers that I can then take to the African Union. And then this issue of the albinos came up while I was there last time teaching, and so he said, well, let's make that one of the primary issues and see if we can't get something done. Unfortunately, I have no guarantee of continuing because his term is up in 2014, so there will be a new president then of the International Law Division, and I can't guarantee what's going to happen or whether the next president will even have an interest in this. But we're going to try to strike while the iron is hot, see if we can at least get it on the table. I will say, though, that my experience so far has been that this does not seem to be a priority for very many people in the upper echelons of government and politics. Now, granted, you know, you've got, you know, countries that are very unstable right now, and you've got civil war in Nigeria, and you've got situations in Egypt and Tunisia and places. So maybe that's the real reason. But nonetheless, we would love to see this get a lot more attention at a much higher level and make the
Absolutely.
Crimes and penalties much stiffer. And if it were addressed from the top down, we really believe that people's attitudes would begin to change much more quickly than they are.
I would imagine. Well, when you mentioned that some members of the government appear to be complicit, I know in the article it said that there may be some people in government who buy some of these body parts themselves because, I don't know, they feel they can win an election?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, these are, for lack of a better description, these are their rabbit's feet.
Oh,
these
gosh.
Are their good luck charms. And this goes so far back, nobody really knows, but the albinos, when they're born, are believed to be evil spirits. And so to kill one and conquer one, then you kind of take its power, and the assumption is, well, I would only use the power for good, so better for me to have it than for it to be lurking around and maybe doing something. And these cultural myths are really, really hard to undo. I've talked to a number of people and just asked them casually, what about this? And you can see that the remnant of this myth is alive and well.
Mm. How do you explain this? I know you have, in addition to everything else that's going on in your lives, you're raising four children, and they have been to Tanzania with you. How do you explain this to your children, this kind of horror? Corrine?
Well, three of our children had lived with us over in Tanzania when Eric had his Fulbright Fellowship.
Uh-huh.
And so we can always draw on that. And actually, just in our daily life, we oftentimes will tell the kids, maybe if they're having a problem of some sort, you know, we'll say, well, now, you know, you have clean water today and you have full bellies when you go to bed tonight. And so now with this albino problem, we're actually very open in our household, and we talk about a lot of issues in the world and just socially. So now with the albino problem, you know, we've been very open with them about it, and we can kind of draw on that again and say, you know, you guys get to go to bed tonight in a very safe environment. You're not worried about someone coming and taking you to chop off a finger or an arm. And so we just try to be very open with our children. These things are real. They're really happening in the world, and we want them to know about it.
We're going to welcome phone calls if you'd like to join this conversation. I would imagine to some of you listening, this is new information and horrible to hear, I'm sure. But Our guests are doing everything in their power to change this. We're talking about albino children in Tanzania. There are more albinos in this part of the world, East Africa, than in other parts of the world. And they are persecuted. They're killed sometimes, and body parts are sold because of superstitions that go back generation and generation, that you'll become a better person at fishing if you've got a finger from an albino. And some of these body parts are sold for huge amounts of money. It is something that our guests who have worked in Tanzania for many years were not aware of until relatively recently. And by golly, they're doing everything in their power to change this. They're working on putting together a refuge, a 10-acre site on the edge of the Serengeti for 200 children with who are albino children. They are also trying to get rid of this stigma. It's like a modern-day leprosy, and how do you go about doing that? Through government bodies, through changing a culture. It's a tall task. They have done volunteer work all over, and particularly in Africa, and we welcome calls for our guests, Dr. Eric Booz, Karine Booz. They are lawyers. They are Karine is a physical therapist, and Eric is a philosophy professor at the University of Wisconsin, Fond du Lac. They have four children. They are also organic farmers. They're building a law school in Tanzania. They are pretty remarkable people. And here's how you join our conversation, if you would care to. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can get a hold of us in any of those methods. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's our phone number, 1-800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And we start our calls with Rick in Lake Geneva. Hi, Rick.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Good. You know, I was really fascinated with this whole thing about the albinos over there. And I have some friends who are missionaries over to the Datug tribe. But I'm just wondering, is this, the albino situation, is there more albinos that you're finding in certain type of tribes over there that's out in the bush? Or are there more albinos in the cities? Or where are you finding most of these albinos? You're saying there's 180,000 in Tanzania? That sounds like a huge number.
Yeah, that's just an estimate by the BBC. The number might even be a little bit higher. And albinism is not confined to just Tanzania, but the preponderance of it genetically is in East Africa. So there's also quite a few albinos in Uganda, quite a few in Kenya, some in Malawi and some in Zimbabwe as well, a few in Rwanda and Burundi. But the single highest concentration is in Tanzania. And as Murray Brilliant from the University of Arizona described to us in his research, he's spent most of his career researching albinism. The preponderance in Tanzania is basically because socially they can usually only go with other albinos, and so that increases the odds of more albino children. And so the trait tends to concentrate. And also, his research shows that that's where the trait originated. And I can't do much more than that. I'm not a scientist, but the basic description of it is that there's an enzyme that needs to be present at conception, and it's called tyrosine, and it's a copper-carrying enzyme. And when the genetic disposition to block that enzyme is present, then the melanin that normally would be in the skin, which is the pigmentation, it doesn't form. And so the concentration is there. They believe it originated in East Africa and probably in Tanzania, and there's a lot of different theories on that. But certainly the highest concentrations in the world are Tanzania. It's about 1 in 2,000, whereas the rest of the world, the tendency of this genetic trait is 1 in 20,000.
Hmm.
Okay. Are they targeting mostly children, or do they target adults as well?
They do quite often target the adults, and I guess one of the real tragedies is many times the parents are complicitous in these murders.
Really?
The fathers in particular. And so what happens is if the family is maybe facing a drought or facing severe poverty and they have four or five children, if one of them happens to be albino, a decision will be made, and the father will find one of these what they call bounty hunters and arrange for them to come in the middle of the night. And some of the children that we've met that have been mutilated but lived have been held down by their fathers while somebody takes a whack at them with a machete.
Oh.
And we have 30 that we care for right now in Lamadi Village, and many of the 30 that we have were brought to us by their mothers trying to save them from their fathers.
Hmm.
So there's a real, there's an economic, I don't want to say incentive, but there's an economic idea behind this, and because the children are believed to be evil spirits anyway, and the father's other children are maybe facing starvation, it's kind of a utilitarian calculus. The one can die and feed the rest, and so it's just a terrible tragedy. And when the mothers come and drop off their children, they're so grateful. But if they try to protect their children or stand in the way of the bounty hunters, and they're out in some small village, you know, villages can range from 20 people to a few hundred people. There's no communications, there's no police, there's no street lamps, there's nothing. So if the women stand in the way and try to protect their children, they'll be killed as well.
Oh. Thank you for your call, Rick. Trina in Watertown, hi.
Hi. Yes, my question is, if you gather 200 of these special children together in one location, won't that be a special then target for the bounty hunters? Won't they be in mortal danger? And how will you protect them? How do you protect the 30 that you have right now?
Right, that's a fantastic question. And believe me, we have labored over this for over a year. there is no easy solution. If the children remain isolated and live secretive lives in their small villages, they're very vulnerable. They can easily be abducted and killed in the small villages because there's no police. There's nobody to protect them. But bringing them together, yes, it has become public. They know we're there. But we worked hand-in-hand with the government to pick a site location. And the government, I think, acted very wisely in this. They said, let's put them in a high-profile, high-volume tourist traffic area. Because the local economy depends on tourists, then everybody will have a vested interest in making sure there's no violence, because if it happens, it could hurt the tourist trade.
Hmm.
So they put us at the western gate of Serengeti and close to Lake Victoria, and it has been a wonderful strategy. The
mm-hmm.
locals have embraced the little village that we're starting. They're all on board. Everybody now is kind of looking out for them. We still do have two armed guards. We have guards 24 hours a day, and it's a walled complex. I mean, we have to be careful and we have to be realistic. But it was a tough decision, but in the end, it was much easier to bring them together logistically, because then we can provide them the medical services they need.
Yes,
getting them their sunscreen, their sunglasses, their hats, providing for their education. All of that becomes infinitely easier when they're in a central location. Our long-range goal is that if we can effect a successful campus model for 200 children, that this model then can be duplicated throughout East Africa. And then ultimately our goal is not to keep them confined forever on a compound, but to get them completely educated and then help them get into the civil service sector and get into positions in the government and get into positions where they're more high profile, so that we can break this cultural myth. But it's not an easy decision. There's risk no matter what we do. Karina and I are even at risk when we travel, if we travel with albinos. It is the reality. But as Karina had mentioned, for us, this is just such a situation of justice. We couldn't say no when we were confronted with this. We had to do it.
Yeah. Thank you, Trina, very much for the call. If you had been there for so many years and didn't realize this was going on, imagine the shock when you would tell people in the United States or in other parts of the world. Is there an international effort that's going on in some way to change all of this? You mentioned the African Union. What about the UN? What about various organizations in the United States, Eric?
Yeah, that's a great question. In fact, there isn't a coherent, singular movement within the world, but there are many, many international organizations and NGOs working on this issue, and we are by no means original or unique. There's even quite a few here in the United States, like Project Mariamu, with a great website, and we want to work hand-in-hand with all of them. But we would like to streamline the effort so that we can generate a little bit more power, you know, have a little bit more impetus in terms of changing the laws and getting things done. And on that note, it's very interesting that in the United States, we even have a law that protects the albinos of East Africa. And I'll let Corrine talk about that because she's spent a lot of time researching.
Sure.
Yeah, we found it very interesting that actually in March of 2010, there was a House resolution. It's House Resolution 1088, sponsored by Gerald Connolly from Virginia at the time. And this is a resolution to support people with albinism in East Africa. We kind of say that it's probably a law without much teeth, but it does symbolize that the United States wants to address the issue. Sections of it call for the condemnation of murder and mutilation of adults and children with albinism for their body parts. They want to support people with albinism in East Africa who have been victims of attacks. It wants to recognize that these acts are a gross violation of human rights. And then it also urges the governments in East Africa to try and prevent this further violence and bring to justice those that who have engaged in it. It calls upon the governments in East Africa to work with international organizations to just educate the populations of East Africa about the realities of albinism, again, in order to eliminate the discrimination and these abuses. And then it calls upon the United States to work with the governments of East Africa and international organizations to eliminate the violence against these people.
Let's go to Carl next in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. I, as the guests were speaking of just this, you know, just hard to fathom situation going on in East Africa, I think it's important for people to remember that we here in the States have owned other people as property not too far back in our own past. The
You're
church
right.
convened to decide whether black people have souls. You know,
mm-hmm.
we as a human species are capable of horrific crimes, but
mm-hmm.
also of tremendous generosity and grace. And I just wanted to applaud the guests for approaching this matter factly, for speaking honestly with their children about it, and for changing minds, changing the kinds of ideas that go on in people's heads that can allow, you know, really horrible thoughts to exist there, or can really turn that around and turn it into, you know, a hopeful and healing future. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Carl, that's a fantastic point, and I just want to elaborate on that just a little bit. I mean, he's absolutely right. The human species has done horrendous things in many occasions. And the one thing that I try to remind my students of when I'm teaching here in the United States is, as bad as the situation is, and we can be very judgmental, at least about, you know, the fathers who are selling their own children, I try to remind my students to think as objectively as you can that most of us here, when looking at this, we haven't ourselves experienced abject poverty and starvation. And so it isn't real beneficial to be, you know, overtly judgmental about it. Better to just work on this issue and let's see what we can do. I would like to take a big picture approach and say that, look, if we could build economies of scale throughout Tanzania and East Africa, there wouldn't be these incentives to sell body parts. We just have to do more, I think, in terms of helping developing countries. And we have to work on a lot of fronts. So, you know, Carl raises a very, very good point. It's not something we're going to conquer, you know, overnight, and we got to battle it on many fronts.
Yes. Thank you, Carl, so much for your call. Robin in Duluth. Hi.
Hi. Well, my whole thing is that in Native American culture, albinism, especially like buffaloes, is a sacred thing. I don't know why other cultures are anti albinism, but you know, in North America, it's a spiritual, special thing.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I can't answer why that's the case, but anywhere we've been on the African continent, it has not been viewed as something special or worthy of you know, protecting. It just has been quite the opposite. I couldn't even begin. I'm not a cultural anthropologist, so I couldn't begin to guess why that's the case, but, you know, sadly it is, and you know, just on a genetic point of view, albinism does occur in all vertebrate species. So, yeah, you do see albino buffaloes, albino deer, albino crocodiles, things like that. So, but why it's a negative thing
yes.
over there, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I imagine you'll find out at some point, being there as much as you are. Robin, thank you very much for the call. I understand. Let's talk to Corrine about this for a moment, that the family, I don't know if the plans are still the same, are to go to Tanzania and teach and perhaps establish an organic farm sometime this winter. Is that still on?
Yes. At this time, originally we had thought to take the whole family in January. However, given the fact that, you know, it would cost the entire family $12,000 to fly over, the kids all decided that it was more important for the money to go toward helping the albino children versus them going over this time. I should mention, too, that actually my kids donated our first $7,500 to our Zero organization. And so this January, Eric is going, again, to kind of get things established. And then as we, you know, get more money and start building the campus, then I believe we'll be heading over and possibly more long-term. But, yeah, we want to teach them sustainability, and we can draw a lot of that education from our own running of our organic farm. Right now, you know, we raise animals. We have an organic garden with a whole variety of vegetables. We have an orchard and fruit, and we do dry beans, potatoes, and carrots. And so we end up saving all of that and preserving it. And it's an entire family effort where the kids know and they're expected to help from planting to weeding to harvesting and preserving. The whole process is all, you know, done with our family. And then profits from things that we sell from the farm go to the organization.
Uh-huh.
And then also, you know, I have taught myself how to make soap, and we do lots of crafts. My daughters are making cards that they're selling in our local coffee shop to raise money for the kids in Tanzania. And so we kind of want to take all of these ideas that we have and head over there and just help them develop their sustainability.
I don't know how you do all this. It's like you really have all these lives going on at the same time.
Well,
it is truly remarkable.
The main thing is we don't have television in our house. That gives us a lot of time to get stuff done.
There you go. That's very interesting. It can take up time, can't
it?
Yeah.
Corrine and I are both chronic insomniacs, so we... In our entire married life, we rarely get more than 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I read somewhere in the article that you were in law school and you were up reading and studying until 2 in the morning, and then you'd be up at the crack of dawn. So you've done it for some time, huh?
Well, it's a great point of pride for us, especially for Corrine. She raised 3 very small children, made the dean's list, outscored me in every common class we had. She also worked 2 part-time jobs, and we never used a single babysitter for the 4 years we were in Madison. So. She deserves to be proud of that. She's a Wonder Woman.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you both are. So you are thinking about moving to Tanzania for the long term? Is that
We really are.
In fact,
it will be difficult to give up the organic farm. We would in a heartbeat if we could make it work. One of the reasons we haven't done that sooner is because part of what we decided when we got married was we always wanted to be countercultural. We love the United States. We love what it stands for, but we're wary of things like consumerism and capitalism and what our priorities are as a culture. And so we purposely try to be countercultural. I mean, it's why Corrine makes soap for the family and shampoo, and she even makes her own toothpaste.
Oh.
Just as a point of, you know, to teach people that there's something very valuable about learning to do for yourself and not be reliant completely on a consumer-driven economy. And we're finding that a lot of the things that we learn from the people of Tanzania, we bring back home. I mean, this is not a one-way street. I think both of us are in agreement that we've probably learned a heck of a lot more from them than we've taught to them. We just really learn the value of family and community and simplicity and a work ethic. I will tell you that when I teach in Tanzania, I wish my students here were as dedicated. It's just amazing what we learn from them, and the spirit that in the bond that we have has really transformed our lives. Many, many times we sat down as a family and said, okay, can we extract ourselves from this whole Tanzanian experience? Can we be done with this now? Can we just settle down and stay put and focus on one thing? And no sooner than we would say, let's do that, something else would come up. And it's just true that Africa gets in your blood. So we're drawn back in. And I think because we grow as people, the more we help, the more we grow. It's not what our intention is when we start out, but that's just what happens. And it's been very powerful, transforming experience.
Yeah, I'm sure. And your example is something that you have to, people have to stop and think about the way that you live and what you're doing. You cause people to stop in their tracks, I think, and examine how they're living and think about what it is you're doing.
Well, it is exactly that. And it's not always easy because sometimes our kids come home from school and they get teased a lot.
They go to
public school and the kids call them Amish and, you know, you don't have a TV and you don't know what the current shows are and they're not running around town and spending money. They're very focused. They're wonderful children. And Corrine was right earlier when she said, you know, when they lived with us over there for a long period of time, they experienced life in a different way, that they view the world differently. And we try to get them as best they can to share that with their peers. But it's a very hard thing to do. But they try. They're into it.
So they're not bothered by the teasing, I would imagine.
Not too much. For them, it's also kind of a point of pride. At some point, they enjoy telling their friends, we don't have TV in our house. So.
Right. So you what?
Yeah.
You don't have TV?
Yeah. Yeah.
We welcome more phone calls. Our guests this hour are Eric and Corrine Booz, and they have really so many stories to tell. They have been doing a phenomenal amount of work in Africa. We're talking in Tanzania specifically. The story that really was news to me and was to them, even though they had been there for many years because it's so much underground, is pigment prejudice. It's an article that was in the University of Wisconsin Alumni Magazine recently, and they found that children with albinism are sometimes hunted in Tanzania because of superstition, and this runs from people who fish to people who are in government positions, that body parts may bring good luck. And so they are killed for these body parts, and then the body parts are, it's gruesome, but they're sold in markets for, depending on what the body part is, up to $35,000. So they decided that they would bring attention to this issue, and also they are working on a school. They're developing money now to build a support network in the United States and also to build a 10-acre site on the edge of the Serengeti into a camp. It would be a refuge for some 200 and perhaps more children who are albino children so that they can study, so that they can be with each other, so they won't feel this threat that keeps them inside frequently with their mothers, that somebody will get them and kill them or cut off part of their body if they're outside. It's quite a story. And the whole lives of Eric and Corrine are big stories. They are organic farmers. They are not consumers. As you heard Eric say, they grow their own food and they can it, and their children don't watch television because they don't have a television. And both of them are lawyers. Professor Eric Booz is a professor in the philosophy department. I mean, how do they do all these things at UW Fond du Lac? Corrine is a physical therapist. They have been 20-year volunteers for all kinds of organizations, and they are thinking about moving permanently with their children to Tanzania because it is drawing them and because of the importance of this work. We welcome your phone calls. Here's how you reach us. A few minutes left in the show. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lines are open for Eric and Corrine. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I mean, in addition to witnessing these horrors and trying to counter them, I was also struck by the fact that you were both in Tanzania in 1995, and you talk about how people waited for days in the rain to cast their votes in the country's first democratic multi-party election. That's an image and an event that you witnessed that I'm sure is impressed deeply on your minds.
It was really something. For two young Americans who have more or less taken our political system for granted from the time we were able to vote, to stand over there and watch people vote for the first time and come out of the voting booth and crying tears of joy and having the ability to participate in the formation of their own future was really, it was enlightening, it was moving. It gave me a lot of talking points for when I'm teaching classes here in the United States about political processes and stuff. And it was really profound. And to watch Tanzania change from a diehard socialist state from 1961 until 1995, they were diehard socialists under President for Life, Julius Nyerere, a wonderful man. But then to go to join in the global economy and to be a full-blown multi-party democracy was really, really profound. And culturally, things began to shift right away. And for us, just to see how peacefully the elections were conducted was just very moving. The power that's there is just amazing. Part of what we realized right away, though, in 95 was if they're going to make this thing called democracy work, they really are going to need more education. More people have to have a deeper understanding of how this process works, because other countries around them, launched into democracy and didn't have that educational basis, and it ended up with violent elections and bloodshed, and parties just swapping power back and forth every 6-8 months. Tanzania has been spared that for a lot of different reasons. Tanzania is a tremendously peaceful place, in spite of this horrific tradition of hunting albinos, which is a terrible cultural tragedy. The rest of Tanzania is absolutely phenomenal, just a wonderful, peaceful place. 122 tribes coexisting peacefully, a long record of peace, never any civil strife, no civil wars. They've just been an island of peace in a sea of tumult around them. So they've embraced this well. The globalization is always painful, change is always painful, but they're doing it in about the best way possible, at least from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's been great to watch.
I imagine. Let's go to Karen in Jefferson. Hello, Karen.
Hello. I did see a documentary on this a couple years ago, and they were comparing if there was anything in common with leprosy. You mentioned leprosy, Kathleen, and that reminded me. And they didn't. They did it. They had a study out there. They brought sunglasses for the albinos and everything, and did a test. But that's not what my call is about. I did with Karim being a physical therapist, and also the both of them, I was wondering if there's something about the skin of an albino that couldn't tolerate prosthesis, or have they seen prosthetic devices on these kids that have lost body parts to this?
No, there would not be any problem with them getting some prosthesis and their skin handling it. That's a really great point. I don't think those opportunities are out there right now. That's maybe something more that we'll look into also for the kids. But there's really not a large prosthetic equipment in Tanzania right now. One of the other projects that we worked on, I helped with a physical therapy program and a clinic. We did a medical mission and took some equipment over, and we were able to train a prosthetist to make some things at that special clinic.
Oh.
Yeah, and then we also... we also worked to manufacture walkers and standing frames. With my knowledge of physical therapy, I was able to teach one of the priests that we worked with, and we got a welder for him from Pacific Cycle in Madison. That was one of the other donations that we had gotten in the past, and we were able to send the welder over, and I designed some standing frames and walkers for the children, and Father Gabriel was able to put these together. And one of our most favorite pictures that we have and experiences that we have is seeing some of these young children up on these walking frames and walkers. They just took off. It was the first time that they could actually walk on their own without someone helping them. And they were laughing and bumping into each other and just being children, and so
that's great. There's no end to this.
Yeah,
what you're doing over there.
Oh, thanks.
Well, I'm just amazed. Is there a way to get a Facebook picture on Kathleen's site with that, or not really?
We do have a picture. Maybe we can get some more pictures. But
I mean, of like these the kids walking on the
Yeah, devices. We'd have to. Can you get one of those to us, Corrine? Do you know or?
Yes, that wouldn't be a problem at all.
All right, let's do that, and okay. Then we'll put it up on Facebook.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
okay.
I know.
Oh, that'd be great.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Karen, very much. And because people are going to hear this hour and want to help you in some way, is there something up and running for donations, Corrine?
Actually,
or Eric?
We're having a lot of problem getting the website set up because we're having difficulties with the domain name. We wanted it to be 00, but apparently there's a man living on Zanzibar that doesn't want to give that up.
So.
He likes
course.
The name, so we can't get it from him. And
funny.
We were struggling with whether or not to go with a longer name and something like Save the Albino Children. But we don't have that up and running yet.
Okay.
What we have been doing is just having people connect Corrine through her email account and go about it that way.
Do you want to give that or would that be too much?
Oh, that'd be fine.
All right.
It's just Boos, BOOS dot Corrine. KARENE at gmail.com.
BOOS dot Corrine, KARENE at gmail.com.
That's it.
Good. All right.
And we have, on account of the On Wisconsin article, which I have to say was beautifully written.
Yes, it was.
I don't know how she took 20 years of our history, as discombobulated as it is, and made it so flow so well. So she's a terrific writer, and we were very appreciative. And we've had just a steady stream of people connecting with us and offering all manner of assistance. I mean, just last week, a company out in Colorado is going to donate 100 pair of very good sunglasses. And so we'll be taking those over in January. And, you know, people want to help, and that's fantastic. And we'll accept, any help that we can get. We're hoping, I mean, you know, foundations are usually a little hesitant to throw big money at newly emerging organizations, and that's understandable. You got to develop your credibility and such. We're just hoping that they kind of see the urgency of this, and know that these little kids are facing a very tough future, and hoping that they'll see their way to donate sooner rather than later.
Yes,
we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Yes, thank you, Karen, for your call. Stacy in Madison. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Stacy.
I was listening to the program, but I only got the tail end of it, and I was wondering how you started this mission that you're doing now, and how did that come about to you?
The specific mission with the albino children came about because actually one of our friends who we helped sponsor to go to Edgewood College in Madison, Wisconsin, her name is Sister Helena Natambulwa. And she's a Tanzanian sister, a Catholic nun, and we sponsored her to go to Edgewood. And then she went back to Tanzania, and we didn't hear from her for almost 10 years. And even though we were traveling back and forth, we could never really track her down. And so we knew she was out in the bush somewhere doing work, but we didn't know what. And then in January of 2012, we got a rather random email from her, and lo and behold, she tells us that she has a new mission, and she's working with albino children, and that's really how it started. And Corrine and I just want to be really clear about this. The real hero in this whole story is Sister Helena. I mean, she is there every day, 24/7, caring for those kids. And, we're back and forth. But she's the real hero, and she's very courageous. She's willing to put her life on the line for kids that, nobody else wants.
Hmm. You're not too bad yourselves, Eric.
Well, we've been blessed. We're lucky.
Stacy, thanks for the call. Quick comment from Sarah in Zion. We're almost out of time. Sarah, hi.
Okay, hi. Here's a big question. I am totally with you on the anti-consumer society. These days, considering that we can't go hunting and gathering, how are we going to change that?
10 seconds, Eric.
Oh, my. Education is the key. What I find is there's just a lot of people who don't know where to even begin. My strongest recommendation to people is start to simplify your lives. Go through your house and start separating your needs from your wants. And the more wants you can live without, the more power you find internally. And it goes from there. Not everybody has the luxury of having a 40-acre organic farm like we do. We're blessed. We're lucky. But if more people could have a little bit of ground of their own and start doing this for themselves. It's a very empowering experience, and I think we're better off for it. We need more people directly connected to our food chain, and I say that not only as a farmer and a philosopher, but as a parent who's watching their children eat things that we wish they wouldn't.
So. Thanks, Eric, so much for being with us. Carry on. Fantastic work.
Thank you.
Eric Booz, Kareen Booz, we thank both of them for being with us. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show, to Robin Cherry for on-air production. Go to our website page. We'll get some of those pictures up for you. And the story is worth reading, too. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show.